Andrew Talks to Chefs is an independent podcast. For current and past episodes, Andrew's blog, contact information, and more, please visit andrewtalkstochefs.com. To support us, please visit patreon.com/andrewtalkstochefs. Enjoy the show.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
I learned a lot about taste in that meal, about how my tongue and my mouth really were the cook and the seasoning, and not so much the food itself, which was very plain, but I was able, through attention, to bring qualities to it.
That is the voice of Deborah Madison, author of the new memoir, An Onion in My Pocket. Our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. Our guest today is something of a legend. Many of you, I'm sure, know the name Deborah Madison. If somehow you don't, which I think is unlikely for the listeners of this show, I will introduce her properly in just a moment. Before I launch into today's episode, I just wanted to take a moment to say that I don't know what to say right now. Obviously, the United States, where I live, and most of the globe is again or still in the grip of this pandemic. For the restaurant industry that's already been pummeled this year, it's obviously another gut punch. And, you know, it's very grim right now. If you're out there listening and you're in the industry, or you're out there listening and you love restaurants, depending on where you live, there may have recently been another shutdown in indoor and or outdoor dining. Restaurants are closing for good with more frequency. A number of restaurants in New York, where I live, are deciding to go into what I guess I would call hibernation, hoping to, you know, get through the winter and reopen in the spring if they can keep up with their rents and whatever other ongoing expenses they have. But it's very depressing. It's very sad. It's very concerning. And personally, I find it incredibly upsetting. And like I said, I don't know what to say about it other than to say that I wanted to acknowledge it. You know, we've been with this situation now for about 10 months in the United States. In some parts of the world, obviously, it's been going on a month or two longer than that. You know, it's kind of like when you go to the food page of a newspaper or the newspaper's website, or you go on social media and half of what you see is, you know, holiday tips and gift buying guides and things like that. And the other half of the news is, you know, this ongoing scroll of places that are either temporarily or permanently closed and all of the different issues that have cropped up around the pandemic and what that means for this industry and other industries. It's a bit of a, you know, it's a schizophrenic time. I am going to just jump into a normal interview because our guest is a great one and her book is a terrific book. But just, I need to acknowledge where we all are. And if you are out there, I hope this show, this sounds corny, but I hope maybe it's a welcome distraction. I hope maybe it helps you fill the time if you're not working or you're working less than you usually are. I do have a bit of a backlog of episodes from when the weather was nicer and the COVID numbers were lower in New York, and I'm going to try to get those posted as soon as I can over the next days. I actually have already cut an episode with Bo Beck, and I will release that later the same day I'm releasing this show with Deborah, or possibly on Wednesday morning. But hopefully these are at least a bit of a welcome distraction or a bit of welcome normalcy. I also want to take just a quick second to point all of you to a new website called Restore. That's RESTORE.biz, B-I-Z, Restore.biz. It is a new website that serves essentially as a clearinghouse for online sessions, exclusive live experiences, and curated products, all of them available exclusively at Restore.biz. It is supported globally by our friends at San Pellegrino. And its mission is to help food and beverage professionals build more resilient businesses through creative new revenue streams. And Restore, and I'm just going to read it in their words, was born in response to COVID-19 and its devastating impact on the global food community. Cracks in the very foundation of our industry were suddenly exposed, and thousands of our favorite restaurants were forced to close. Against the toughest odds, we cheered as friends and colleagues around the world creatively pivoted their businesses to survive the pandemic and thrive beyond it. Joining them in this mission, we are here to help restore hope, reset the status quo, and rebuild sustainably towards tomorrow's table. And if you purchase any of the experiences, sessions, or products on this site, the only thing that does not make it to the chefs and restaurants themselves are the operating costs. So 91% of what gets taken in on this site goes actually to the community chefs. The other 9% is to cover credit card transactions, platform maintenance and salaries, and marketing expenses. So I'd like you all to check that out. Again, that is restore.biz. So with all of that said, I'd like to introduce Deborah Madison. I think Deborah is probably known to many of you for her work as a chef. She was the chef of the, I would say, landmark restaurant, certainly a very influential restaurant called Greens in San Francisco. She's the author of such classic cookbooks as The Greens Cookbook and Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone. Those are both monumental books that are continue to be popular today. I first met Deborah, gosh, a little more than 20 years ago. My wife, Caitlin, who some of you, if you listen to our early episodes on this show, used to sometimes do the introductions with me. Back when Caitlin was a publicist for the Broadway Books imprint, she did the PR for Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone. And when Deborah would come through New York, we would sometimes see her socially, often, you know, along with the publisher and her editor and whoever else fit into the picture at that moment in time. I just thought always that she was the just nicest, most sincere, thoughtful person. And we reconnected maybe 2-3 years ago. She was nice enough to give me an interview for my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. But apart from that, I don't think we'd had any contact in about 20, 22 years, which is a crazy thing to hear come out of my mouth, but that's just the way it is. And Deborah has now written a book. It is called An Onion in My Pocket, and it is a memoir. And I would say that this is a book that probably lives on the same shelf as something like Alice Waters, Coming to My Senses, or Jeremiah Towers' book, California Dish, which was updated and republished more recently as Start the Fire. And what I mean by that is, it is a book that intertwines Deborah's personal story, the story of her relationship with food, with some movements in the food world that, you know, are bigger than she or anybody else. Obviously, from what I just told you, that would include how vegetarian cooking has changed over the last decades. That would include what vegetarian restaurants now mean to people out there in the dining public. And just in general, what it is to be a food enthusiast. Neither of us, as you'll hear in this interview, particularly like the word foodie. You know, but Deborah was in the mix kind of when that whole notion of an American food enthusiast was becoming a thing. I mean, it's hard to imagine now, but, you know, it wasn't all that long ago, certainly within many of our lifetimes, that a lot of what we now take for granted in terms of what's available to us to eat and drink out there, you know, there was no audience for that 40, 50 years ago. It's a relatively new development in this country, and this book tracks that, as well as Deborah's very open, honest, and as always with her, exceedingly modest accounting of her own life and career. So I don't think I need to say anything else about it, except that the book is currently available. You can get it wherever you get books. I will link to an online location where you can find various buying options on the episode page for this show on andrewtalkstochefs.com, as well as on the listing for this episode on Apple Podcasts, where the links are functional. And with that, let me get you to my interview with Deborah Madison. Here you go. We interviewed, I guess, for my book, but other than that, I don't think we'd been in touch at all probably in about 20 years.
Yeah, I know. Something like that. Something shocking.
Before we start just, you know, really talking about you and talking about the book, I have two confessions. One is a million years ago, my wife, Caitlin, was doing the PR for your book, which I guess in hindsight, we would now say was sort of a landmark book, Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone.
Oh, right.
Now, that was 1997, but that's how I know you, because when you came to New York, we would all go out to dinner. And one time, you know, I didn't realize how, no pun intended, how green I was about the whole food community. And I said to Kate, well, why don't you invite Deborah over for dinner? And I cooked dinner for you. Do you have any recollection of this?
No, but go ahead. I like it.
Well, the confession is first of all, I had no business cooking dinner for anybody. You're too modest to accept this, but I'm just going to say it. But, you know, anybody of your stature, that was insane. But I made a pasta with morels and asparagus tips. Mm-hmm. And when I brought it to the table, you said, oh, how lovely. And then you said, what did you do with the stalks? And I lied to you.
Oh, okay.
I think I told you I was going to make a stock, but in truth, they were in the bin. So I'm sorry. And then my other question was going to be, how bad was the dinner? But you don't remember it. So that's probably for the best. The other thing I needed to say to you was I know a lot of people don't do this before they have people on their show. I always, you know, read people's books start to finish. I was in my car quite a bit the last few days, and I've never done this, I think, for a pre-interview. I always kind of like to sit with the book, but I thought, you know what? I'm going to use my time. I'm going to do the Audible book. And I was delighted the second it started playing to realize that you actually did the reading yourself.
I did. And it was fun to do. Surprisingly.
Had you done that before?
No, never.
Can you, I know this might seem like an abstract or esoteric thing to start the interview with, but I gotta say, for me, it really was a great, not only did I not feel like it was a diminished reading experience, I feel like because it was you, that it was an enhanced reading experience. I'm just wondering what that process was like for you.
Well, it was very, very tiring. And it was just before lockdown here. I think we did it at the end of February. We shut up everything in March in New Mexico. And it was fun to do, but it was exhausting. You know, that, I mean, you don't think that reading is so hard, but it is. It really is.
Well, no, I mean, to focus for that long, first of all, I imagine it had, I don't know how many hours a day you did, but I imagine it had to have some kind of put a strain on your vocal cords or your voice.
Oh, yeah. And you're in a dark room all by yourself and you're not sure when you're supposed to start and you start at the wrong time and you have to go back and do it again. And then you have somebody listening in from New York who tells you, you didn't pronounce this word right, or you, let's do it again, and a little more emphasis on such and thus. And it was very hard actually to do, but it was fun. I like reading.
For what it's worth, I mean, to me, it was great to have your voice. At first I thought, you know, is this cheating? Is this not really reading? But, you know, when you go see someone do a reading at a bookstore, that's a very special moment. And to me, this was like having the privilege of having that just extend, you know, for whatever, 9-10 hours. Anyway, I loved it. I thought you did an amazing job with it.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew.
All right, let's talk about this book, An Onion in My Pocket, which is such a great title. I try to avoid spoilers, so you get into what that means pretty early on in the book, but I won't get into that. But I'd love to talk about, in the book, you describe a childhood largely through isolated details. And I definitely got a picture of it, but I had the question I came away with a little bit, which I was sort of dying to ask you was, how would you just, if I asked you to put an adjective or two to yourself as sort of an adolescent or, you know, very young teenager, how would you describe your general outlook? Because there were a number of signs of what I would, I think, consider a rebel, but you don't really describe yourself that way.
But I was that way, actually, in high school and junior high. But I was really just trying to grow up and be a kid and have a normal life, which was very unlikely given my parents and where we lived and how we lived and all of that. But I also was a rebel, especially in high school. In junior high school, I was just going steady, finding out about boys, clothes, and all that. On the other hand, I used to play in the orchestra, and I'd throw my violin in the bushes, go to school, and as if I didn't have anything to do with music at all, and go through a day, and then come home and fetch my violin out of the bushes and go in the house. It was kind of bizarre, I guess.
I'm glad I asked, because you do give these details. You know, you talk about, certainly with your mom, you describe who clearly you loved, but, you know, some personality challenges. And, yeah. You know, you describe yourself as you say you were the first of your friends to smoke pot. And this was not a time, right, where you could walk into a dispensary, to put it mildly. There were a lot more stigmas attached to it.
Oh, yeah.
So those things really stood out at me. And, you know, I know you as such, or I perceive you as such a sort of centered, you know, relatively tranquil person. And, you know, as these details were adding up, I thought, she seems like she's maybe even a little angry as a kid.
I could have been. I was a little more angry later, especially with my mother, when I realized how she had kind of held us back as kids in some ways, because she was very interested in her own career. And I think kids were, you know, not that important to her until she was very old.
You talk early in the book, you talk about food people, right? You go on this sort of aria about food people, what it means to be a food person. You know, food people show up, they come to visit and they show up. One of the ones I loved was, egg cartons packed with figs, right, in each of the little compartments, and or a bag full of, you know, whatever, or gallons of, you know, cream, whatever it is. It was so interesting to me to hear you actually define that. You know, I think for people who, you know, very sort of myopically are in that realm, which I guess I am at this point, you sort of take it for granted. You tend to become surrounded with a lot of people who are like that. It was very striking to me to have you sort of spell it out like that. And it occurred to me it was because, at least, you know, certainly in the United States, I think, you know, you were there. I mean, the word foodie wasn't even a word yet, right? I mean, I feel like you were there when the notion of an American food person was kind of being forged. Is that a fair statement?
I think it probably is. And all those gifts of food that I mentioned, you know, they showed up with people when I moved to New Mexico, which is not California at all. It's not Flagstaff either, but where I moved first, but it's really not California. So things like figs and quinces mattered a lot to me. They really did. And you're right. I mean, the word foodie I don't even like that word. And it's a fairly recent word, as far as I can tell. Don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, relatively. Yeah. Relatively.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't like it either. I actually don't know anybody who does. The power of senses, I think, Deborah, is something that came across very strong to me in this book. You know, you talk about this revelation you had as a young eater, where you kind of realized the role of your own senses, your own palate, your own appreciation. You speak of it as I think the word you actually use is ingredient, a factor in the success of a meal is what you bring to it as an eater. And that, to me, was a very powerful notion. I'm just wondering if you could speak to that for a moment.
I think you might be talking about that meal in my first sashim.
Yes.
So at that time, I was quite young, and I was trying to satisfy some anxiety around food by getting lots of sweets in my mouth and soft textures and the like. And then I went to a sesshin, which is a 7-day period of intensive meditation. And this was a long time ago. And it was, I've gone on to sit many sesshins since then with much more complex food and delicious food and more formal serving. But at that time, we used to get up to get our food and we could stretch, which I was very grateful for. The food was so simple. It was white rice with a few toasted sesame seeds scattered over the top, a salty miso soup, and pickles. And I had just come back from Japan the week before where I'd been eating the same pickles. And there was something about this food that was in such contrast to what I had been looking for on my own. And it was so good. I loved it. And you'd think, oh, it's so plain, you know, it's so austere, it's so this, it's so that. But for me, it was quite an incredible experience to be sitting and eating and finding how much flavor and taste and quality there was in such simple food. And then a friend of mine reminded me that Suzuki Roshi, who was our teacher at that time, used to find such meals very austere, and he didn't really care for them. And when he was served them, they'd go out to breakfast, he and David Chadwick, afterwards, and have bacon. I don't know about the bacon, but eggs and toast and, you know, coffee and normal food like that. But for me, this was really different, really, really different. And I learned a lot about taste in that meal, about how my tongue and my mouth really were the cook and the seasoning, and not so much the food itself, which was very plain, but I was able through attention to bring qualities to it.
Something else that struck me as you go through, you know, the early days of your story is, I guess what I would call the role of anticipation in being, you know, an emerging food person or evolving food person or developing food person. You know, there's many times in the book where you'll talk about reading about something. You know, at one point you talk about reading about it and getting on a Greyhound bus, you know, and going to the city to experience it. You know, there's obviously in this time we're talking about a lot of dishes. You know, you talk about Craig Claiborne's international cookbook and Marcella Hazan's, you know, books. And it seemed to me like the role of imagination and the role of anticipation were also a huge factor in how your experience of food played out.
Well, I did go to San Francisco a lot, and you know, and I discovered certain foods that were there, and then I'd follow through, and I'd get home and go back and get more tastes of piroshki or whatever it was that was interesting to me then, and the Marcella had won. Came much later. Claiborne came later too. They were the books, I mean, Craig Claiborne's books was one of the only books I had that inspired me as a head cook at Zen Center. And I liked it a lot because he had many foreign cuisines in there, and it was the moment when cuisines were coming out of ethnicity. Into the culture at large. So you could find recipes for ratatouille, for spanakopita, and things like that. And you could also find in the same chapter on Greece or on France or wherever it was, dishes that would go with those. So I could cook with a kind of sense of a whole rather than pieces, which I really, really liked and appreciated a lot. At that time, we had nothing to go by, nothing. I mean, there were no books written. Marcella Hazan came and gave a class when Green started, which was again much later. And I think I went to it, but and she was talking about risotto in that class. And it was before it was really like it is now, where everybody has a recipe for risotto regardless, or whole books have been written about it. But to then it was very, very exciting. Everything was exciting, really, because we were just coming out of this dark age, I think, of really horrible and very limited foods.
Yeah, and very, I guess, incurious would maybe be a way to describe the average American diner at that time.
I think that's true, that people were incurious and they were very interested in having time-saving elements, you know, like the TV dinner, which we never had because my parents wouldn't ever buy one. And we didn't even have a TV to eat in front of. But right, things like that, and white bread. And, you know, after World War II, the inventions that were supposed to make cooking easier for women, particularly, that's what people were interested in, I think, a lot. And we were interested at the Zen Center, if in any food at all, and getting back to kind of whole foods. But the problem was nobody knew how to cook those foods. And they were heavy and stodgy, and vegetarian food was pretty dreadful for a while. It truly, truly was.
You show it no mercy when you describe the food at that time. I have to, before I talk about that, you know, you talk about a moment where the Zen Center is... you know, seeking someone for the kitchen, and you talk about your hand shooting up.
Yeah.
You describe it almost, your reaction right there kind of says it,
yeah.
But you describe it, you say you realized at that moment that you wanted to do that, that it wasn't premeditated, that it wasn't something you had even realized until you were presented with that opening, right?
Right.
Can you just speak to that for a moment? Because it was so striking to me that, I mean, you clearly had already discovered food. You were reading about it and you were enjoying it, making these little short pilgrimages for it. But that seems to me like a bit of a Rubicon that you decided to cross that day.
My hand did shoot up when they said, or we said at the house meeting, that we were looking for a cook and would anyone like to do it? And that's when I decided that it seemed like a much more interesting place, the kitchen, to be than any other place in Zen Center. But also, and I'm not sure I said this, I knew it was warm, especially if you were at Tassajara, it would be the warm place to be. And I'd be at the source of food, which was important to me because I wasn't so sure about this vegetarian diet that we were all committed to. So to be honest, there were some self-seeking moments in there, but mainly I just thought it sounded interesting. And the way I looked at it, I was just doing vegetarian food for a while. It had nothing to do with my own experience, which was certainly limited, or my belief, which was not even tried at that moment.
I'd love to just talk about the whole vegetarian stigma of the time. I mean, you know, you can get such amazing now at all different, in all different styles, right? You can get a really fancy, almost, you know, like not even almost, like a fancy kind of Michelin directed kind of, you know, vegetarian meal today. You can get a casual meal. You can go, there's fast food, you know, quick casual concepts, you know, there's everything. But at this time, you know, I was reading your description of it and it reminded me, There was an old Woody Allen movie called Sleeper, and where he gets, you know, whatever, suspended animation. He finds himself in, you know, way in the future. And that character had owned a health food store called the Happy Carrot, which that's actually what came to mind as I was reading your descriptions. You say at one point, you know, in the book that you wanted to avoid all the cliches like the broccoli quiche and the fistful of alfalfa sprouts, you know, sticking out of a sandwich. And, you know, I was around for a lot of that. I remember a lot of those cues. But you also talk about what seemed to me of, if I'm just going to put a word, it's not a romantic word, but you seem to me to have an incredible pragmatism about how you went about what you did at Greens. You know, you talked about, at one point it becomes kind of comical, right? Like you would, start putting cheese on things to the point where all of a sudden there was cheese on everything. But you did talk about wanting to draw in non-vegetarians, that you wanted to draw in what we would think of as, you know, the average diner, right? The average guest of a restaurant. But it seemed to me like there was such a, to me, forward-looking at the time, sense of realism, sense of not letting the, you know, the perfect be the enemy of the good, a sense of maybe what was, what, again, what to me, what was practical at that time. I'd love if you could just speak to that bit of analysis that you seemed to do at that point in your life and career.
When Greene's opened, there were people were very interested in it, partly because of the Zen connection and the location and the fact that there was a lot of free parking and it was very easy then to get to. And a lot of women came in particular. And then when we opened for dinner, they brought their husbands back. I mean, we were vegetarian, and that didn't mean that we couldn't have dairy. And everything was very rich then, not just in our restaurant, but in the 80s and early 80s. People everywhere cooked with cream, with butter, with cheese. Now, I did tend to, as I found out while writing this book, put cheese in dishes where it wasn't even called for because I was so nervous about people coming in and feeling that they would leave satisfied and not hungry or not as if something were missing. So that was the cheese episode for me. And plus, when I had been testing the recipe for the restaurant at Zen Center, people say, this is great, it just needs more cheese. So cheese, you know, cheese seemed to be the theme, the key. But it was a very wonderful time to be cooking because there were no vegans, I don't think. We had one customer who didn't want cheese on his salad, and I don't know why he didn't, but we could give him a name. We called him Non-Dairy Jerry because we knew that he would always say, I don't want cheese on my spinach salad or whatever it was. So we know we could give him a name. People ate wheat. They ate all kinds of foods then, so it was fun to cook for them. I must say I'm glad that I've missed the era that I'm sure everyone has gone through where things have to be vegan and gluten-free and this and that and the other thing. We just made food and tried to make it beautiful and good and bright. What would really make me happy would be if a person, when they got their plate, said, yum, you know, or something like to that effect. It looks great and it tastes great. That made me so happy. That was the best.
Well, that reminds me of something you talk about late in the book. I think it may even be I think it may be the last chapter where you talk about this, about, you know, the idea of nourishment. And you talk about, you know, that it can be not just, a couple of times you say some variation of the phrase that the food itself or the ingredients themselves almost become incidental to, you know, I don't know that you use this word in this place, but, you know, what a lot of people would call kind of the intention of how it was cooked, the spirit in which it was cooked, the sounds that happen in a kitchen can be very, very soothing and very meaningful to people. Food can be very simple and be very deeply satisfying and nourishing. But to me, that very much connects with what you just said.
In that chapter, nourishment, I discovered exactly what you're saying, that food can be nourishing for any number of reasons, and it doesn't really matter whether there's meat on the plate or not. And so I describe a bunch of meals that I had, and some, you know, involved the kind of food I would never eat or want to eat or would ever buy, like, you know, steak from a cow in a CAFO. I have no interest at all in buying or eating. But sometimes I would go to someone's house and that's what they're serving, and it was fine. When to answer your earlier question about what we expected, I never wanted anyone to jump through hoops for me. And I'm so glad you invited me to lunch, Andrew. and that you cooked it, because you can't imagine how rare that is. And a lot of times people won't ask you out because they don't know what to make, you know, and they assume you're vegetarian. And I never wanted anybody to have to jump through those kinds of hoops for me. So I always said, whatever you make is fine.
No, and I believe you when you say that, but you're also being very modest, Ever. Don't you think it's people don't invite? Listen, there's, I've had people, I'm not a chef, right? I just write about you guys. But I've had people say to me that they waited 5 years to invite, you know, me to dinner at their house. And that's crazy, right? But you actually, you know, you are a person of stature within this realm. I would think people are just intimidated to cook for you.
Well, that may be, but anything would be fine, even a burn care. I don't really care.
Right.
I just like
right.
to eat with other people.
At this time, I'd love to get a sense of, I guess, how you remember it. Because there's one point in the book where a lot of different threads are sort of coming together. You know, you're talking about, you know, Claiborne's book. You're talking about going to see Marcella Hazan. You're talking about kind of the shift that's happening in food in the United States in general. You know, I would think that as exciting as all of that was, right, when all of these influences and possibilities were rushing at you, as I was reading it, I found myself with the question of, was it ever overwhelming? Was it ever overwhelming to all of a sudden have almost endless possibilities and all the, you know, all these things that you were reading and pondering? I would think in some level it might have been hard almost to pick and choose and to make decisions at that time.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I still have little notebooks that are filled with ideas from books. In fact, I was just looking at them yesterday, filled with ideas of things to make and where to choose, you know, how to choose, what to choose. It did get overwhelming. You know, there was just so much, and it was so exciting.
I think more than most people do when they write a book like this, which I happen to love because it's a realm that I've spent a lot of my career in. You talk about your book life, your life as an author. You talk about the book tour. You talk about the book tour when the book tour was something that, well, first of all, it was more of an assumed thing by an author. It's more rare today than it used to be. You know, publishing budgets aren't what they used to be. A lot can be done over the internet. But I'd love to know what it's been like for you thus far, talking about this book, you know, during a lockdown. What's that reality of promotion been like for you?
It's both a plus and a minus. And the plus part is that it's easy to do a lot on Zoom. And thank heavens for my friend who has better connectivity than I do on Zoom. The minus part that's not so good is that you don't get to see people. Like, I don't see you right now. And I know this is a podcast and it's different, but on Zoom, you don't get to see people. You don't get to interact. You don't get to hear their response or their boredom or their shifting in their seats or laughter or whatever might be there. You have no idea. And that's kind of characteristic, I think, a lot of what we're going through right now. And it's, that part's not so gratifying to me.
So if we were not in a lockdown, you would have tried to, as much as one can these days, you would have tried to kind of be mobile and hit some of the usual stops?
Probably, but then it's just the usual stops. On Zoom, I can go all over, not just in the usual places. I can go to Washington, D.C. I can go to Duke University. I can go far. I can travel on Zoom in a way that I wouldn't be sent, probably. I'd probably just go to Northern California and, you know, where I have a reputation and fans and friends, and would do all that again. So in a way, I'm happy to be doing this, like doing it during a pandemic. On the other hand, there are drawbacks too.
You spent some time describing what it's like. You know, you talk about going to the market, you know, and the frenzy of a market. And, you know, when you got back, the kind of, you know, getting stuff unpacked and getting to work. And you know, it struck me that a lot of things, again, I would just love your comment on this, if you think it's an accurate comment and however you might want to expand on it. But it seemed to me that the extra degree of difficulty that was involved in almost everything about cooking had a huge silver lining to it, which was the familiarity that you got to develop with, I mean, just with product. It seems to me like the act of physically going to markets and even needing to be a little quick about what you did when you got there. Was kind of a blessing in disguise.
I guess it was. And I think what you're talking about was before Greens, when I was the head cook in the city. And we used to go, there was only one farmer's market, and that was the Alemany Farmer's Market. And then we'd go to the produce terminal. There wasn't a lot of food then. You couldn't just go to a farmer's market and buy good food. There were no heirloom vegetables then. I mean, there was nothing really, but it did make us attentive and sharp, you know, when Greens finally opened, I think, to what you had to do to get good food. And I really had to learn that again when I moved to Flagstaff and there was nothing to eat as far as, you know, a West Coast person was concerned. But I found ways you could find good food to eat. And that was even harder than jumping through hoops in the city.
There's a moment, and I, like I said, I try to minimize spoilers, but I just wanted to talk about it because I thought it tied up so much of your story. You talk about going to your father's funeral in upstate New York. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it harkens back. I don't know if this was intentional or not, but, you know, it harkened back to the way you defined food people, because you brought a bunch of his favorite foods with you to sort of celebrate him. And then there's a moment involving, I think it, this is, I'm learning this is the downside of listening to a guest book on tape is, or on Audible is, you know, I've gotten a couple of details slightly off. I think it was scotch. Am I remembering correctly?
Oh, yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Scotch.
You know, but to me, it was this wonderful sort of weave, this moment that in the, you know, like in a way that any novelist would have been happy to come up with, that kind of just tied together a lot of threads from the book in this very simple moment that you describe. But I'd love if you could just talk about talk about that moment and why you did that, because it seems so, no pun intended, but it seems so organic to me.
Well, I brought food because I thought you were supposed to. I didn't really know I had never been to a funeral before, to tell you the truth, and I just thought there should be food, and it should be the food that he loved and that he liked, and so I did. I brought a whole suitcase of it for six people, and we, after the funeral, we spent some time talking about my dad, and then I was suddenly so exhausted with the whole thing, and I looked down, and there was a bottle of Lafroy, and I said, is that my dad's, perchance? Oh, yes, because his caretakers were teetotalers.
And yep.
So I poured, I just reached down and got it and poured myself a glass and raised it to my dad and thanked him for his life and for everything.
When I read you describing this moment, it did remind me of how just the power of food. I mean, it sounds very trite to say it out loud or to put words to it, but the power of our senses, the memories that are triggered by taste and smell, it all seems to me to be quite, I mean, that's just something that periodically in life I'm struck by. It seems like you are too.
I am, and it's true. I mean, I think food memories are when they work, when they're profound, when you really taste it or smell something that makes a difference, you don't forget. You just don't forget. And so many people have been amazed. They say, how can you remember all this? And I say, well, it's really not hard. It's your life. And it's our moments in your life that really matter. And it's not so hard to remember. It really isn't.
Well, also, I don't know if you know this. I forget where I learned it. But do you know that the sense of smell, which obviously is closely associated with taste, is the most powerful trigger for memory.
I had a very primal moment that I write about in the book, which is so different from my mother, who always was apprehensive about food. I was going to have the oil changed in my car, and I went upstairs where we waited, and there was a sandwich. And I took it because it was free and because it was food. And it's not because I was hungry or I wanted it or I wanted to eat what was in it or anything like that, but that gesture awoken me this feeling of being an animal, you know, that it was such a basic kind of thing to do, to take it. And, you know, it's only in our human world that we have this excess where we can say, oh, I don't want that. No, thank you. It shocked me.
Do you go through phases in your own cooking these days? Do you tend to get kind of, do you tend to fixate on a certain type of food or a certain dish and kind of just kind of settle in with it for a spell? Do you, what, how are you cooking these days?
Well, in the pandemic and being married to a man who grew up eating a lot of meat and who has had cancer and who craves it several times a week, I find myself cooking a lot, and I'm also getting a CSA for the very first time because I've always wanted to choose what I get, but now I kind of like the surprise of seeing what's in it. And as I'm looking out at snow on the ground, I'm thinking, what's in it these days is pretty boring. It's all root vegetables,
right?
You know, and I'm all for roots, but you know, I realize that, oh my gosh, it's going to be like this for the next few months. During the 3 weeks when we have tomatoes and eggplants and peppers, there are lots and lots of dishes I love to make. But basically, I'm a seasonal cook, so I get into what we have at the moment. And what we have now are turnips and rutabagas and potatoes and carrots and maybe a few leeks. And I have to go back and think of what's in my box this week. Winter squash, and there's a lot you can do with it. But I don't know how to answer your question because I feel like this time is kind of a special time. You know,
sure.
I cook a lot of recipes from my own books, which I've never been able to do before. And I find I like them, that they're good.
that's a good thing. It's funny even to hear you say that, because I kind of imagine you, to put it in musical terms, I kind of imagine you improvising more than I imagine you playing, you know, from the sheet music. But it sounds like maybe it's the opposite.
Well, I am a very improvisational cook for sure. But right now, I'm grateful for a recipe because, like a lot of people, I'm a little tired of cooking dinner every single night and breakfast every single morning. You know, there is a kind of fatigue that settles in.
Deborah, what prompted you? I mean, you've done so many books. I mean, obviously, you know, cookbooks for the most part. But what prompted you to write this book? What was your kind of main motivation to finally sit down and do something like this? Because it's no small thing to write a book like this. I mean, you share a lot of your life. You share a lot of very open feelings, complex feelings about people in your life, about organizations and groups that you've, you know, been a part of or been associated with. I mean, it's a lot to put out there into the world. What made you want to do that?
Well, I don't know if I should tell you this or not, but it started a very long time ago. I was given a fellowship for a month at Hedgebrook, which is a writer's colony in Washington State. And at that time, I was very regretful that I hadn't gotten a PhD in anything, and because I really wanted to be useful in the world, and it seemed like that was what I should have done. Anyway, I went to Hedgebrook, and I wrote about that. And then I went to Ireland for 2 months because Patrick had a fellowship in rural Ireland, and I continued writing. And then when I reread it, I couldn't stand what I wrote. And I thought, oh, it's so whiny. Really? Really? Is this all there was? And there's got to be something more. So I just decided to buckle down and see what that something more was, what really mattered. And originally, I wanted to call this book My Vegetarian Problem because I'm always slated as a vegetarian, and I've never really been one. And I just wanted to write about that. And as you know, it just became one chapter. And I'm glad it did because, you know, uncovering all these other things was important to me. It was interesting to me that I had had the life I had had. I don't know what else to say.
I mean, I guess the other thing you could say if you wanted to is it sounds to me like maybe you either learned some things about yourself going through this process, or maybe certain things that maybe you hadn't thought of in a while, or that you didn't give prominence to, certain, you know, positive things or positive ways of looking at things maybe emerged to you through this process. At least that's what I heard in what you just said.
Yeah, it did. It did very much. And that was interesting. But one reason I wrote this book is because I felt I had come to the end of cookbooks within my kitchen. And I took Patrick and my first husband, Dan, out to dinner, and we raised a glass, and I said, this has been a great career. Now I'm going to stop and do something else. I'm not quite sure what that something else is yet, but anyway, I did this. I'd been working on it for a long time, and I'm glad that I did. And I did learn something. I learned what mattered to me, what was important in food, which was how it's cooked, whether it's offered with generosity or kindness or care. And that was really the clinker for me. Not whether there was meat on the plate or not, but that was it.
Is there anything that hasn't come up yet as you've been talking? You've been doing some interviews about the book. Is there anything that, you know, you walk away from these interviews or you think back, you know, after a couple and you think, gosh, still nobody's asked me about X, or, you know, there's this one thing in the book that I'm so damn proud of, but nobody's asked me about it. Is there anything that you feel maybe hasn't been, for whatever reason, people haven't stuck on yet that you are especially interested in them gleaning?
Well, I was very interested, and thank heavens you picked it up in the last chapter. And so many people have not read it, or they forget about it. And so maybe it's not that important to them. But the vignettes about meals I do remember, and that last part about Lobsang's funeral and the strawberries, nobody has ever asked me about that. And I'm kind of sorry that they haven't.
Oh, wow. Well, you just said it, right? So the last chapter, again, not much of a spoiler, is one of the longer chapters actually in the book.
Yeah.
Where you relate some meaningful meals, and you sort of talk about, I guess one could say you wax slightly philosophical about what it was that made them memorable or meaningful. It does build up to this very, 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 very specific moment that you just alluded to. But you know, again, for me, and I think as a writer, this would mean something if someone said it to me. So I will say it to you. I did find myself reliving meals in my own life that I hadn't thought about in years as I was reading that chapter.
That's good. That's wonderful. Thank you for telling me that.
So for what that's worth, I don't know what more you could ask from a piece of writing. I mean, I learned more about you, and I remembered some nice things about my own life. So thank you for that.
Well, you're very, very welcome, and thank you for telling me.
And And that's our show for today. My great thanks to Deborah Madison for calling in and speaking to us long distance. Deborah, it was great to hear your voice. Again, if you would like to purchase Deborah's book, An Onion in My Pocket, please do visit the episode page for this show at andrewtalkstochefs.com. You will find a link there in the show description that will take you to where you can purchase the book online. The link will also be featured on the episode listing for this conversation at Apple Podcasts. Our thanks, as always, to After School Special for our music. Please check out their album Double Barrel Single Entendre on iTunes. Please follow us on Instagram. The handle there is at Chef Podcast. And if you would take a moment to rate or review us on Apple Podcasts, it does help more people find the show, and we would be eternally grateful for that. Thank you for listening, and we will see you back soon with another episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs.